You know, the snow and the ice and all those kind of things, you know, depends on where you're at in the country, whether how you react. If you were from Wisconsin and you saw what was outside today here in southern Ohio, people in Wisconsin would think, this is nothing. Come on. You know, they wouldn't even think twice about going out. This is like they'd probably be in T-shirts and shorts and stuff and going outside. Well, for us, this is all kind of perilous. Well, if you live in Houston and you have 3 inches of snow, now, that's a different story. My kids have grown up around here and they've seen the snow and all of that, so they thought, this is nothing. It wet the streets was all it did and accumulated a little bit in a few places. And the kids said that, but they let my son-in-law out of work at noon and my son out of work at noon because they were all freaked out and panicked and they're like, what's the problem here? But they were glad to go home anyway, so they didn't fight that. But and my daughter said there probably isn't any toilet paper or bottled water or any of that kind of stuff left in the store because they're all panicked because of something we would think is just minor. But anyway, it just depends on where you're at. And in Houston, you don't have snow very often, so when you have it, everybody gets all freaked out. I know in L.A., this guy was talking about rain. And he said, you know, if it rains more than 28 drops in Los Angeles, everybody comes unglued, you know, crashing into each other and all kinds of problems. And you're thinking, we're talking rain. We're not talking snow. So anyway, it's what you're used to. But anyway, they've survived the big storm there in Houston, and life is going on. So what makes a community? What makes a community? Basically, a community is just a group of people who live in the same neighborhood. And when we think of a community, usually we do so in positive terms. We see the neighborhood as a group of people who share life together. We have the same values and culture. And, you know, and many times, you know, and sometimes you have communities where everybody knows each other and they're neighbors with each other and have some relationship with each other, and then you have neighborhoods where nobody knows each other. You have people who live in apartment complexes that don't talk to each other. I know when we lived in Dallas, we were the only weirdos on the street that opened our windows when it was warm and nice out. In Dallas, what they did is they went from heating to cooling and then back again. They never opened any windows or anything like that, whereas we thought, wow, the air is nice, and it's a nice temperature, and we'd open the windows, but we were the only ones on the street doing that. And our neighbors, we would see them, but they would come into their garage and pull in their big black car, and they would pull out in their big black car, and that's all we ever saw of them. And so anyway, we didn't have much of a relationship with them. But, you know, communities are different. Some people are very close, some aren't. To be part of a community, there are responsibilities and certain rights. For instance, if you live, some people choose to live in a gated community. And you have the right to the passcode to get into the gate. And you also have the right to keep people that don't have that code out, where they're not soliciting you for donations or selling you things or whatever it may be. Also, you probably in those kind of communities have very strict rules about what you can build, how you build your house, how you maintain your lawn, what you can put up outside. Can you put a flag outside? Can you do any of those kinds of things? And you have rights and you have responsibilities if you're going to live in that community. And in whatever community we live, we also have those rights and responsibilities. And it seems that wherever people are at, they do form communities. If you go to most high schools, you will find that at that high school, the kids have formed various communities. And if you're an adult just observing, you'll see the various communities because they'll all be congregated in these different communities. Now, I can, when I was a kid, we had the jocks, we had the socias, and we had the hards. We had basically three communities. The jocks were the people that were involved in athletics. The hards were the guys that wore white T-shirts, pointed black shoes, and jeans, and squatted down a lot. And then the socias were the people that were kind of the more social gadflies and popular people and all of that. And you had these three groups, and many times these groups didn't interact. and they would be defending. You would be defended in your group. For instance, you know, the people in I ran track and cross country and played baseball, so I was part of the jock community. Well, they could pick on me. They could hunt me down and drag me across the baseball field through when it's raining and it's muddy, and that was perfectly acceptable. But for other people to do something like that, they would actually defend you because he's part of our little community, and we can pick on him, but you can't. So anyway, they would give you some protection. And, you know, today you see you have gangs, you have some similarity to what my school was like, but it's just in more of a modern version. We want to be part of a community where we interact with other people and where we have people that know that we have a shared set of values and a shared culture. We share a life together. And this doesn't mean we're all going to be exactly the same. We can all be a part of the community and share certain values and similarities, but we're all individuals. We're all different. The smallest community that we have in our world is the family. And it is foundational to society. It's why a good marriage is so important and why good parenting is so crucial. And when it works right, you not only have a husband and wife, you have a mom and dad, you have children, you have grandparents and cousins and aunts and uncles, and you have a community that forms together and has positive relationships. And the family, that is what God intended to be the basis for other communities. The church is supposed to be a community. It's not just to be a place where we all come together once a week, get some knowledge, say hi to each other, and then adios. It's to be more than that. Paul noted this in Ephesians chapter 2. Ephesians chapter 2, when Paul wrote the book to the Ephesians, the letter to the Ephesians were Gentiles, primarily. And so they came from the Gentile world. And Paul makes note of the fact that they came from that world and they had no familiarity with the Bible. They had no familiarity with God's plan and who God worked with. And they were excluded to a degree from that community because of the separation between the Jews and the Gentiles. But Paul makes note of the fact that as God called these individuals, things changed. Let's go to Ephesians chapter 2, verse 14. It says, "For he himself is our peace. Through Jesus Christ, there is peace between the community of God and the Gentiles, who has made both one." So he's made it possible for the Gentiles to become a part of what God is working out, and has broken down the middle wall of separation, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, that is, the law of commandments contained in ordinances, so as to create in himself one new man from the two, thus making peace. This isn't speaking of the Ten Commandments. It's speaking of the separation between Jew and Gentile. And through Christ, that's over. There is no physical nation that God is working with that he's trying to keep separate from the world. He's working with a spiritual nation that he's trying to keep separate from the world and its ways. And he tells us how to interact with the world in a number of different places. So Christ made peace between these two communities. He says in verse 16, "And that he might reconcile them both to God in one body through the cross, thereby putting to death the enmity. And he came and preached peace to those who were afar off, and to those who were near." Those who were afar off? The Gentiles were afar off. And who was the group that was near? Well, it was those people, the physical people, with whom God worked. "For through him we both have access by one Spirit to the Father." So we are bound together through the Spirit of God. Verse 19, "Now therefore you are no longer strangers and foreigners." See, these people were Gentiles. "You're no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone." You see, God has taken Jews and Israelites and Gentiles and put them all together to form the church, to form a spiritual nation, to form a community. It says, you know, we have now entered a new relationship with God. And the Gentiles are welcomed into that community as God calls them. And we create a community of saints, what might be called the household of God, as he refers to it here, that it is the household of God. And we are part of a family now, of whom God is the Father, Jesus Christ is the elder brother, and the family is different from any other community. This community that we've entered into has special laws that govern staying in the community. For instance, we are told, you shall not steal. Okay, so if we start stealing from each other, you know, you all, those of you who save seats, you leave your briefcase here or your Bible here or whatever it is, and you come to church and you sort of expect it to be there. And if you come and it's gone because somebody has taken it, then that doesn't help our community, does it? What kind of confidence do we have in the community if that kind of thing takes place? If we start shooting each other, that probably is going to damage the community. How long can we remain together if we start killing each other? So there are very specific rules concerning how the members of the community are to act. And we know that those rules, the law of God, should apply to all communities. And if they did, it would make a world of difference in how the world acts. But we all well know that the world has not accepted the law of God. And so the world is going its own way. And, you know, even as we all apply the law in our lives, does that mean we can't be individuals? No, it means we're individual, but in character, we're all the same. Not all people on the earth at present have an interest in being part of the household of God, and we are here because we were invited by God to be a part of it. So we're no longer strangers and foreigners, and we are to come together and form a community. And if we are a community, then Christianity is much more than just our personal relationship with Jesus Christ. Okay, our personal relationship with Jesus Christ is vital and important. But if we are a community, then it means that it's all not only about our relationship with Christ, but it's our relationship with one another. We are brothers and sisters in Christ. That's why we are referred to as brethren. We are brethren. And you know, as we form a Christian community, we form the household of God, we all come from a particular culture. We all come from a particular culture. For those of you who are native to southern Ohio and northern Kentucky, there is a particular culture that exists here. It is a particular culture. It's a culture that has influences from West Virginia and Kentucky and some influences from the rest of America. Most people speak English here, but believe it or not, you do speak with somewhat of an accent. Okay? Nothing wrong with that, but you do speak with an accent. I know my cousin, she worked at a store that they dealt with New York. And she's from North Carolina, and she speaks with an accent. And she was speaking to people in New York, and they would just say, "Boy, you have such an accent." And then she would say back to them, "So do you. You talk like a New Yorker, you know." And they have a distinct accent. You know, you've probably talked to people with those accents. But anyway, we have English. We're English speakers, but there is a detectable accent. You know, it's the only place I know in America where they call green bell peppers mangoes. Okay? Now, some of you may not have known that, but they do. Nothing wrong with it. I mean, it's just part of the culture here. People here are tied in closely with their families, and this is a well-armed community. not all communities in America are as well-armed as in southern Ohio. I mean, we kind of laugh, but it is true. You are well armed. So because everybody's well armed, I'm expecting them to protect me because I don't have any armaments. But anyway, and there are certain characteristics that are common to people in this part of the country, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's not a better culture; it's just one of many that make up the United States. And having lived in several different places in my life and my wife's life, we've had to adapt to where we're living. You know, we've lived in Illinois, and we've lived in, you know, which was more of a, they had some industry there and farms, and then we lived in Missouri, which we lived in the city, and then we lived in Dallas, and we definitely lived in the city there, but they were all unique. You know, the first time we ever experienced the chicken dance was in St. Louis. And you've got that kind of German music. Well, in St. Louis, at one time, you had a lot of Germans there that lived in St. Louis. And that influence was something that everybody was comfortable with. And then we went down to Texas, and they all did a dance that was common to Texas. Not the Virginia Reel, but it's kind of a, I forget what it's called now. But anyway, that dance was common there. And that was Texas. And so every place has its own particular background. And, you know, as we've moved around, we've felt the best thing we can do is bloom wherever we're planted. So we're in southern Ohio, and we're going to make the most of it. And not every culture, aspect of culture is displeasing to God. But there are, we know, certain portions of culture that God says those don't fit with what I'm trying to put together. So inside the church, we are not trying to duplicate Southern Ohio culture or any other worldly aspect of culture. We're trying to create a godly culture. We're trying to establish the household of God here. I know that another thing that was many of you are used to in this part of the world is peanut butter sandwiches with chili, and you find that appetizing. That's okay, but I'm probably not going to do that. And I found out something. And now, not everybody does that, but that was a common feature with your school lunches, and maybe you did that at home too. And I like that. And then something that I do like is when you have barbecue, you put the coleslaw right on the sandwich. Well, I'd never done that. That was kind of a violation of the barbecue code, you know. But that's okay. That's okay, and I've learned to enjoy it. So what is the culture of the church? We know it has to differ in certain ways from the world around us, no matter what the cultural background we come from. And it has to be different because we are the household of God. And, you know, there are some things about the culture that we have here that are interesting that I am going to talk about in the future, but not going to get into it today. But there are some interesting things about some of the cultural heritage that we have in this part of the world. The first, as you think about the first Christians who were called into the church after Christ's death, they probably had a more difficult time creating a church culture than we do today. And we're not speaking about the Ten Commandments or keeping the Sabbath. I'm talking about the environment in which people relate to each other, our rights and responsibilities to be part of this community. We filter out those things that shouldn't be part of the household of God, and you know it's a constant battle. We all have to fight that battle, and we live in a world that is media-driven today. And all you have to do is watch the media for a while, and you see, there are elements of this I need to be fighting and resisting and averting my eyes from. You know, just think of this, and it's just to illustrate the point of how we have to fight the culture that is around us. One of the songs played and greatly enjoyed, it appeared to me, was the song "Friends in Low Places." Okay, all right. And now it's an upbeat song, and people were dancing to it and singing along. But when you think about it in terms of Christianity, does it harmonize? Think of the people you know that are in those low places. You know, should we be hanging out with them? Would we want our kids hanging out with them? It's just something to think about. And you can have something that a song we all enjoy, and then you think about, wait a minute, I'm not sure that we should be enjoying that. But it just illustrates the point that we have to fight the media all the time. You know, at camp one year, they played the song, the Kiss song, I'm gonna rock and roll, I forget the name of the song, Party Every Night and all that, and I'm thinking, here you have teenagers here. Is this really the message we want to be sending them? So I brought it up to the person who played the song, and they were a little bit miffed that I brought that up. But anyway, like the song, buddy, but I don't know sure we need to be sending that message to the kids. Anyway, so, you know, that's the we are a media-driven world, and we have to be aware of it and resist it. The Church of God burst forth into a world with enormously different cultures. And in our time, you know, if we went up to New England to live, it would be different. You know, not many people around here say wicked hard. It was wicked hard, which is wicked hard. We don't say wicked hard, but that's what they say in Boston. So anyway, we have to, if we went to New England, there would be some aspects of that that we'd have to adapt to, wouldn't we? But there's enough commonalities in America that you can fit in. I know that, and that's we wouldn't have any problem with that. But if you went to the time of Christ, people were more spread out and cultures were very distinct. You had a Latin culture which was promoted by the Romans. The Greeks had been dominant in the world for a long time. And the Jews had their own particular culture which was found in various cities throughout the Roman Empire. And so you had not only, if you were living in Judea and you moved to Gaul, you would have to deal with language. You would have to deal with religion. You would have to deal with cultural practices. And when the church began in 31 AD in Judea, the cultural issues were probably not too great a challenge because everybody was basically from the same culture. They were all Jews. They were all Jews. They did everything Jewish for the first few years in the church. But, you know, they began to have some problems when the pagans began to come into the church because their culture was very different. Their background was very different. And they had to adapt, and those who were of a Jewish background had to adapt. Everybody had to make adaptations and to form a common community. And they had to come to the realization, we can't be pagans and we can't be Jews. We have to form a community where we can all fit in. What is Christian culture? It's not just the commandments. It's not just doctrines. But what culture do we form that is a unique culture? There are certain aspects of the church culture that you find in that you should find in every church that is truly following God. There are other things that are going to be peculiar to that group of people. You know, you're going to, for instance, all of you do a really nice job on potlucks. Okay? You're good at it. A lot of you cook meals at home. Okay? You cook meals at home and you make your own, you know, you actually make bread, you actually make some pies, you make some cakes. I mean, look at Art McFan. Art does a great job on a cake. And hopefully Art will keep making his cake, but anyway, we'll see. Now that Art's married, he said, I don't need to be making any more cakes, but anyway. But I mean, you guys do a nice job on that. And there are parts of the world where people don't cook. And they're, you know, like, what are you talking about? And they'll bring store-bought stuff and all of that. And it's just a different world. It's a different culture, not worse or better, but it's just different. So, you know, as you look at special music, last week we had special music and Helen Fraley sang, and because we're from Southern Ohio, we can all enjoy that, all right? But if you went to Wisconsin, where they tend to be more conservative and more staid, I mean, if you went to the Dells years ago and up in Wisconsin, you'd have a 105-piece orchestra, and you'd have a 400-person choir, and they would be performing Handel, okay? That's great. Is that better? It's just different. Okay, so they have a more formal approach to special music, and that's okay. So we have to, within the bounds of God's law, it allows all of that. It allows for those cultural differences. It's interesting how the apostles and Paul went out into the world beyond the environs of Judea and began to preach the gospel. And as God would call people out of the world, they were brought to understand the law and the doctrines. But they also had to form a Christian culture. And what we find in the New Testament is an effort by the leaders of the church to form a Christian culture in each community. And let's look at a few places where the leaders of the church had to deal with establishing a Christian culture. And by looking at what they had to do to establish a Christian community, we can learn how to apply the principles in our own community, and we can ask, how can we as a Christian community do things better? Better do things. So let's begin in the book of Titus. It's interesting, in the world in which we live today, you have people that are critics of the Bible, and they're called higher critics. Maybe they shouldn't be called higher critics, maybe lower critics, but anyway, they are very critical of the book of books of Titus and 1st and 2nd Timothy. Because you see, Paul is basically setting standards and limitations and somewhat corrective, and people don't see that as very democratic. People don't see that. Paul would never have implemented such things as this. And so they feel that Titus and Timothy should be excluded from the Scriptures. The pastoral epistles, which are Titus and Timothy and Philemon, should not be in the Bible. But that's another story. But you can see the Bible is being attacked, and you try to throw this out and throw that out, and unfortunately, all you do is damage the standing of the Bible as a whole. So Paul in the pastoral epistles is writing to two ministers, Timothy and Titus, and he's giving them instructions on how to lead in the creation of Christian communities. So he had learned what needed to be done, and he was trying to explain to Timothy and Titus, okay, when you go out and you seek to establish a congregation, these are the things you need to do and to keep in mind. So he tells them to teach sound doctrine. He speaks of the law. But there's actually a lot more in the books that speak of how to create a Christian community out of groups of people. Got groups of people who maybe don't know each other. Did we know, how many of you knew each other before you came to church here? Some of us did, most of us did not. And people of diverse backgrounds in Paul's time. Some were Jews, some were Greeks, some were Romans. Diverse religious backgrounds. Some were pagans. Some were highly involved in philosophy. And just as in our time, some were educated and some weren't quite as educated. And coming from all these backgrounds, they not only had to learn God's way, but they had to learn to establish a culture. And Paul is instructing Titus and Timothy on how to create an environment in which there are shared values in which relationships can take place. With a community come rights and responsibilities, but the main thing is that we build relationships. So let's begin in Titus chapter 2, verse 1. It says, "But as for you," that is Titus, "speak the things which are proper for sound doctrine." So he was to teach sound doctrine, and that word sound means healthy. So you are to teach those doctrines of God that are going to make for a healthy congregation. So, this would be found in the teachings of the Bible. And then he moves on to community responsibilities and rights. And it's all part of the same concept. It all goes together. And if he's going to teach sound doctrine, he also has to teach the following as well. So what is he to teach? He begins with the older men. The older men. Now, what constitutes an older man? 35 maybe? 40? So he's speaking of older men, and he's telling them what they must be. He says, "The older men be sober, reverent, temperate, sound in faith, in love, in patience." So talks about the older men here and says these qualities are the qualities that they need to display. And if you're not one of these older men, you're a younger man, it says he's basically saying these are the men you need to look to in order to follow their example. If they're displaying these qualities, they're sober, they're reverent, they're temperate, they're sound in faith, in love, and patience, then they're men that you can look to and follow their example. They're setting an example for the rest of the church and for those younger men. And it would be assumed that these men are sound in doctrine. They know the doctrines, and they are practicing sound doctrine. And he's telling us how these older men are to relate to the community. So let's look at what these words mean. These older men are to be sober. When he's talking about being sober, he's not talking about they're not to be drunk. He's talking about that they are to have a sound mind. They are to have a healthy viewpoint of life. You know, if these individuals are racked with anger and depression, if they're struggling all the time with lust, if their emotions are out of control, then obviously these older men wouldn't have healthy minds. If the church, he's saying here, is going to be healthy, you're going to have a healthy Christian community, then the older men lead the way by being sober-minded, by having a healthy mind. He's not speaking just of the physical body, but he's speaking spiritually and mentally. They are to be have a healthy mind. So that for the community to come together, we have to have older men with healthy minds. These men are also to be reverent, which means that they are worshipful. They worship in the right way. They set an example that we can follow. They come to services and they help us to see how we should dress, what we should do, how we should talk. That's the responsibility of the older men. It says that they're temperate, meaning they can exercise self-control. And we also find that they are to be healthy in faith. They're to be men known for their faith, men known for love, that is, outgoing concern for others and showing patience. They're hanging in there. They're persevering. The bottom line is when you have a congregation and you have a solid number of men who are like this, you have the foundation of a healthy community. And the more older men you have who are self-controlled, healthy in the way they think, they are solid in the faith and love and patience toward wives and children and other members of the congregation, the more stable that congregation will be. The more men we have committing adultery, constantly making unwise decisions, always having crises of faith, the more men we have not exercising love toward one another, the more men we have that are not serious in their example of worship toward God, the less stable the community will be. These older men are a source of stability for the community. So Paul is telling Titus to teach the older men this is the example that they are to set. Because if you don't, it makes life difficult for whom? It makes it difficult for the women and children. We have a recent, very recent example we can look to that is not in the church, but you can see the results of the person's actions. All we have to do is think of Tiger Woods. Have his actions caused any disruption to his life, to his wife, to his children? It's made a big mess of things. And that kind of thing would cause great upheaval in the Christian community. Titus chapter 2, verse 3, he moves on and he says, "The older women, likewise, that they be reverent in behavior, not slanderers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things." So he says similar things concerning the older women. And the older women are to be reverent. They're not to be slanderers, not gossiping or putting others down. They're to be teachers of good things. And the question is, who are these older ladies to be teaching? And what are good things? Well, you might say that for older women, that would be their children, and that's true. It is a primary responsibility, but that's not what Paul goes on to speak about. It's interesting what he goes on to speak about in verse 4. These older women who are to be teachers of good things, and those things are, that they admonish the young women to love their husbands, to love their children. So they're to teach, the older women are to be an example to the younger women. He doesn't say that the older women are to begin preaching sermons or giving Bible studies, but they are to do things that are going to help to establish the community. And relationships are such that, and they're to do things that are going to help build relationships in the congregation. Relationships are such that younger women see the older women, see their example, and they can follow it. The older women are the ones that they're to go to for questions that they might have. And this implies two things. You have women who are that kind of example, and women who are open to help. And you also have young women who are willing to ask. So you have to have both for this to happen. Women who are willing to help and teach, and women who are willing to go and ask. And as a result of this, a relationship is formed. So Paul is telling us that the older women have responsibility to model certain behavior for the younger women. And what are the older women to teach the younger? To love their husbands. And if you as an older woman don't love your husband, it may be kind of a hard go to explain that. You might have a situation as an older woman where a 25-year-old woman who's been married for a couple of years needs to come and talk to you about how to love her husband. She's finding that her husband comes home and he strips off his clothes. He just leaves them lie where they're at. He doesn't put anything in the hamper. He seems to be sort of critical. And she may have already come to the pastor and received some input. But you know what? I'm a guy, all right? And my knowledge is, I have certain knowledge, but you know, a woman is going to offer you an intimacy and knowledge that I can't impart to you. Sometimes you need the emotional support that you get from another woman. And so Paul said, you know, the older women are to be an asset to the church in this way. And which means that as an older woman, you have to be modeling the behavior that you're going to speak about. So Paul is helping, what he's trying to do here in establishing the community through the older men and older women is to build a community, to build an environment in which relationships can be formed. And we all have to ask ourselves, you know, are we that type of person? Are we the type of person that somebody would come to and say, well, you know, I'm facing this situation, and they would have seen your example and say, you know what, you set a good example. What do you think? What would be your input? What's been your experience? That's the type of community that is being set up here. They're to teach them to love their children, not to just have deep feelings for them, but to love them enough to instruct and correct them when necessary. And, you know, there's a time when mom has to be tough. To be discreet, to teach them to be discreet is what it goes on to say here, which means to be temperate, to be self-controlled. To teach them to be chaste. What does chaste mean? That means pure. It means modest. And modesty is not showing off in a sexual way. You know, we live in a world where, you know, if you were just watching the media, where would you see modesty displayed? Maybe on Little House on the Prairie, but there isn't much in modern media that displays modesty. The chief image you see, you know, if you watch the, you know, we have the Victoria's Secret models displaying the new bras every year. Okay, now what image is displayed there? It is, I'm sexually active and I'm available for sexual activity. That's what the message is. And if you wear this bra, you will be more sexy. And this may prevail in the culture, but it's not part of the household of God. God wants us to be pretty and feminine and to dress nicely and be an individual. The older women are to teach the ladies to be good, to be homemakers. That means that you make a home. It doesn't mean that you, you know, in the modern context, you would do your best, and hopefully your husband would be assisting you in making a home. Obedient to their own husbands. And these things are all to happen in order that the word of God would not be blasphemed. And the point he's making is if these things aren't happening, then people are going to look at the household of God and they will put it down. Saying, hey, you guys are no different from the world in the way you're acting. So he's trying to use the older women as part of the community or to help the younger women come to see how they're to live, how they're to conduct themselves as Christians. Let's go to verse 6, because he not only addresses the younger women, but he addresses the younger men as well. He says, likewise, exhort the young men to be sober-minded. And that's all he says about the young men. They're to be sober-minded. What does he mean by that? He basically is saying, you know, guys, young guys, you guys need to learn to have healthy minds. And the bottom line is that when, that's the battle that young men have, having healthy minds. The bottom line is when we fill our minds with pornography or music that has a satanic message or horror films or senseless violence, or spend all our free time playing video games, what's the outcome? Inevitably, it's an unhealthy mind. He's saying young men, they love to have their minds working all the time. And at this time, the culture makes available to young men a multitude of wrong things to occupy their time. It's abundantly available. And the culture plays right into the way the male mind works. Should we be surprised? Satan has laid the world out the way it is because he knows how the male mind works and knows how to entice it and impact it. So Paul begins with this point because it's where you have to start in order to have a good relationship with God. So young men need to have a work toward having healthy minds. So you can see here the example as you look at what he's trying to do. He's trying to establish a Christian community. And you know, as we go to the family weekend, it is a gathering of the community of God. It is a gathering of the household of God. And just like we go to the feast or we go someplace else, we're all to be an example. But the family weekend draws in many young people to the weekend. And, if you are a young person and you're part of the community of God and you go down and you get drunk and throw up in your room, how does that impact the community of God? You know, there are, you know, things that go on there that are behind closed doors. Not everybody knows what's going on, but you're part of the community of God and you have to conduct yourself as such. You represent the community of God. And we as adults represent the community of God. And we want to all represent that community. Let's go to the book of Timothy, because Paul wrote to Timothy about this as well and addressed another aspect of the Christian community in 1 Timothy chapter 5. 1 Timothy chapter 5. And what Paul is talking about here are widows, and he gives us certain input about that subject. A Christian culture being formed, as it is formed, then the question about widows will arise. And in Paul's time, there was no social security system. There was no social safety net. So what must a Christian culture do in this particular regard? Let's look in chapter 5, verse 3. It says, honor widows who are really widows. Honor widows who are really widows. And he says in verse 4, but if any widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show piety at home and to repay their parents, for this is good and acceptable before God. What's he telling us as far as the Christian community is concerned here? It's saying that the first responsibility in regard to a widow is the responsibility of children, the widow's children and grandchildren. She is their responsibility. And I would think the principle would carry over to elderly parents, not just widows. You know, children in the church should take care of their parents as best they can, do everything they can to help them, is what Paul is telling us here, because it's important to the community. Chapter 5, verse 5. Now she who is really a widow and left alone, trust in God and continues in supplications and prayers night and day. But she who lives in pleasure is dead while she lives, and these things command that they may be blameless. So he's saying we'll know a true widow who needs help because she's living a godly way, a godly lifestyle. And if a widow is going to take the things that the church gives to her and goes out and just spends them on having a good time, then we shouldn't give her any help. We shouldn't give her any help. Verse 8 says, but if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he is denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. So, he's not speaking here of someone who's out of work and facing hard times. He's not speaking of someone who's trying and doesn't bring enough income in. You know, they're trying to make a living, but it's just not stretching far enough. Paul addressed this issue in regard to people who could work and aren't, and could provide and aren't doing it. Paul made the point to the people in Thessalonica, look, if you won't work, then you won't eat. And he's speaking of someone who out and doing it. And the church will not help someone who could provide for their family and is not doing so. So, you know, he's establishing a principle that we seek to implement in the church here. Now, he has to make some rules for the community work, and he's establishing them. Look, you need to keep these things in mind, and probably there are things that came up, you know, as he experienced pastoring a church and working in a church area. Verse 9, it says, do not let a widow under 60 years old be taken into the number, and not unless she has been the wife of one man. So Paul established an age as a baseline to help those widows in need. So somebody that was 60 years of age and would be take and that person of that age would be taken care of by the church in a community manner. And you know, they didn't have a welfare system at the time, and so the church would step in and help those widows in need. We have a government that does much of that in our day. Verse 10, well reported for good works, if she has brought up children, if she has lodged strangers, if she has washed the saints' feet, if she has relieved the afflicted, if she has diligently followed every good work. So it's quite a list of stipulations to be brought into that number if you're going to be considered a widow indeed and be taken care of by the church. There are very specific qualifications. And you don't just add anybody to that number. You look at somebody who's really living in a godly way. Verse 11, it says, but refuse the younger widows. So the issue would come up from time to time when you had a younger woman who has lost her husband. So how do you deal with that? What do you do then? It says, but refuse the younger widows. Do not add them to this number. For when they have begun to grow wanton against Christ, they desire to marry. So in verse 12, having condemnation because they have cast off their first faith. The word wanton there doesn't mean that they're just a bunch of lust-filled women. It means that when they begin to desire to have a husband and a family, then they will leave this group that they've become a part of. And this verse leads many to believe that the church had some type of a home where these women would be taken care of. Verse 13, it says, "And besides, they learned to be idle, wandering about from house to house, and not only idle, but also gossips and busybodies, saying things which they ought not." So he's describing what happens when a 30-year-old woman is widowed, and you have a bunch of ladies together. It's very easy for things to break down. So what should a younger woman do if she's widowed? It says in verse 14, "Therefore I desire that the younger widows marry, bear children, manage the house, give no opportunity to the adversary to speak reproachfully." So what he's saying is, look, the younger widows need to live life. They need to get married and have a family. Speaking, and he's saying, you know, you have a full life ahead. You need to go out and have such a life. He didn't tell the women to go out and get a job, and why was that? Why doesn't he mention going out and getting a job? Because in Paul's time, there were no jobs to get for a woman. They were very limited. The home was the primary place where they would work. And but in our time, you know, it would be perfectly okay to go out and get a job. Get your education, get a job. You know, if you find somebody that you can love and enter into marriage with, then by all means do so. So his advice to a young widow would be to get a life in which you can grow. And don't just recede within a shell and be depressed and negative about life. You can make your life a success going forward. And we can take these principles and apply them in our time. And we seek to do so as a church in order to create a Christian community. Now, there are a whole lot of instructions. If you look for instructions that Paul was giving to these ministers, there are a whole bunch of them that are given, and we can't look at all of them today. They're not only found in the pastoral epistles, but they're found elsewhere. For instance, a healthy church, we're told, should respect its ordained elders. And if there's a lack of respect, then the community will become unhealthy. And if the elders aren't deserving of respect, Paul actually gives principles for dealing with that. But there must be respect for the community to be healthy. Additionally, in the community, if there's a lack of respect of children toward their parents, is that going to impact the community? It most certainly will. And so it will make the home to be in turmoil and will affect the whole community. If there's no respect between elders in the community and the community and the elders, you will have turmoil. You'll have division. And the church will be set up for false teachers. The congregation will be vulnerable. Those are just some of the things he talks about. He goes on to talk about masters and slaves and how they deal with each other. He talks about it in the context of having a believing master. And how do we apply those principles today? Well, we don't have masters and slaves today. We have bosses and employees, don't we? And the principles apply there. He's telling us for the community to work properly, the principles must be applied. Those principles that involve what is a master's responsibility and what is a slave's responsibility. Because they explain to us what a boss and an employee are to do, especially if they are members of the church. And again, for the community to thrive and prosper, if you are an employer and you are employing a church member, then each of you has rights and responsibilities. And usually when that goes awry is when one party or the other begins to exceed or demand more than they should be getting. They actually are demanding more than they should be giving. And both parties have to give, and it causes a breakdown in the community. There, trust me, if you've had that experience, most of you say, "I'll never hire another church member. It was just a nightmare." Anybody had that experience? You probably have. And that's And that's sad. That's a sad comment on the church, that you guys can't treat each other properly. What's that all about? I mean, really, when you think about it, what's that all about? It's about carnal nature being the predominating, and one person demands something from the other or expects something from the other. You know, I haven't worked here a full year, and your policy is to give vacation time at the end of a year, and you're not going to give me any vacation time or demand extra vacation time or whatever it may be. You both have to give. And if that approach takes place, then it works well. Let's look at a specific example that you can look at. We're not going to go through the scriptures there, as in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. And in that chapter, Paul is admonishing members of the church for suing each other. You know, he said, what are you guys doing suing each other? He's telling them the community should be able to resolve its differences. You two, as part of the community, should be able to solve any dispute you have. He sarcastically says, you know what? You would be better off going to the most foolish member in the congregation and having them judge the matter versus going into the court system. You should be able to resolve this. Now you may be saying, "Well, you know, well, Paul went to into the Roman court system, didn't he? He did, but he was never in the court system with members. He was in the court system dealing with the Roman government and basically trying to save his own skin from accusations by the Jews and the religious authorities of his time." So he did use the system, yes, but it wasn't against members of the church. So Paul tells them, look, you guys should be able to work these things out. And he said, in fact, it's so important that you do so, you would be better off being defrauded rather than going into the court system to solve this. He also points out that, we're going to rule the world and we can't solve our own disputes. Another thing that is interesting is found in 1 Corinthians 11. And it's interesting how Paul deals with this. And this is the issue of long hair versus short hair. And in this section in 1 Corinthians 11, Paul takes principles and explains them in order to help establish a culture within the Christian community. There had to be a positive environment in which relationships could be established. And he's laying out for them the principles they need to follow in this regard. So let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and look at verse 14. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 14. He says, he goes through and talks about long hair and short hair, and then he comes to verse 14 and he says, does not nature even itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it is a dishonor to him? He's saying that Paul doesn't go to a specific scripture from the Old Testament in this regard. He feels that God has built this into nature. And Paul believed that it was a strong enough argument to make the case. He doesn't stipulate what long hair is. He doesn't say, well, can you get the ruler out and measure it? Because there is some variance as far as what is long hair, but you should be able to see, distinctly tell men from women. You know, I remember one time as a younger person seeing this person walk down the street with beautiful blonde, long blonde hair. But you know what? Once you got around to the other side, it is kind of nice hair, but I thought it was a girl. But that God says that that's not appropriate for Christians. So what he says is that nature gives us a strong indication of how we should conduct ourselves. And it is an argument that he feels supports the standard of the church. Verse 15 says, but if anyone seems to be contentious, we have no such custom, nor do the churches of God. So he's established that men should have long hair, men should have short hair, women should have long. Please erase that. But anyway, what authority do you use to back this up? Well, verse 16, he says it is a custom based upon nature. And this is an acceptable argument in order to build the community. So as a representative of the household of God, men will not walk around with their hair long or women with their hair cropped short. And the principle still applies today. God made sure these things were recorded in order to give us the principles in order to build a community. In order to build a community. So we are all members of a Christian community. We are to reflect the culture of the household of God. We belong to God, and as a community, we belong to each other. And we are all involved in building the community of God. We're here in the Portsmouth congregation, and we have been called upon to build the community here. And as we learn to build the community here locally, what does it do? As we learn the principles that build a community, what are we to do with that? You know, if you're an older man, you follow the premise that he lays out there, what he's teaching you, and you try to implement that. If you're an older woman, you try to do that. If you're a younger woman, you seek to take to heart what it says there. If you're a younger man, you seek to think about having a healthy mind. Why? Those principles are all fundamental. And as we learn to implement them, then think about the world to come. As God sends you out, what principles are you going to establish a community on, based on? Probably these principles. You're going to go out into a community and you're going to help them learn to have a godly community. So we're all part of a godly community, and we're all being prepared to learn those principles and in the future in the kingdom of God to implement them. So hopefully we all understand better about some of the principles that make up a godly community, the household of God.